welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, October 6, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on ballot selfies as free speech. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert, Stephen Klein, who is an attorney with the Pillar of Law Institute. Steve will get us started with opening remarks. After his remarks, we'll open the floor for questions. Thank you for speaking with us, Steve. The floor is yours.
Thanks a lot, Nate. All right, so this is a fascinating topic that has only gotten far more interesting, not just in the last few months, but even as late as the last week. So to start off, let me talk about exactly what a ballot selfie is, because the definitions are important. Selfie, which has now entered the Merriam-Webster dictionary, is something a lot of people recognize as a photograph of oneself taken by oneself. And with the rise of camera phones, as camera phones have gotten much better over the last decade, we've seen more and more, even the president himself has engaged in this. And particularly here in Washington, D.C., a new invention, which is a cultural horror, though I will argue not constitutional horror, known as the selfie stick, is being used so people can take, I guess, better pictures of themselves. Where a ballot selfie comes in is not necessarily, and this is an important distinction, is not necessarily a picture of one's self, but a picture of one's ballot. There are certainly just a simple Google search, and you can find people have posted pictures of themselves holding their ballot, sometimes pictures of themselves holding a marked ballot. But the issues and the cases we're going to, and particularly the Rideout v. Gardner case we'll talk about today, really deals with just a photograph of one's marked ballot, usually taken within a polling place. But those definitions are certainly those two distinctions, whether it's you holding up your marked ballot and getting a picture of it or just taking a picture of your own marked ballot, those distinctions can become pretty important, as we'll hear later in the discussion. So what did I mean about this being such a fast-moving issue? Well, the idea of going into a polling place and taking a picture of anything in many states is actually illegal. The idea of usually credentialed media are maybe allowed to take pictures, but in particular, concerns with ballot integrity, many secretaries of state and state laws take the position that we can't allow any kind of photography in polling places except for maybe some credentialed media, because we don't want people having their ballots exposed or being harassed or otherwise distracted in the voting process. However, with the rise of camera phones, and particularly in the last few years with the rise of image-based social media sites, we've had Twitter for some time, Facebook. Facebook has become much more of a mobile app, as has Twitter, and now Snapchat and Instagram, which are based almost entirely on visual communications. We're seeing more and more ballot selfies happening. And by this, in the state of Michigan, where I filed a lawsuit in last month on this topic, we have it's just happening. And I think it's people are understanding instinctively that this is political speech. They're making statements about who they voted for, unequivocal statements about who they voted for, and they're sharing it widely across the web. It's probably the ultimate mark of civic pride. They have absolutely no idea what they're doing is illegal, and they're not usually being prosecuted for it. So what's going on, though, at the legislative level is that, and this is just in the last week, the governor of California signed a law that amended California law to allow for ballot selfies. That was on September 29th. On the very same day, the attorney general in Virginia issued an opinion, a legal interpretation, basically allowing for photography of one's own ballot within a polling place, again, so long as that does not constitute any other kind of disturbance, which is a big deal for me because I am a Virginia resident. And then just one day before that, the First Circuit issued its opinion, the first federal court of appeals to address this issue, in Rideout versus Gardner out of the First Circuit, a case out of New Hampshire, and that was on September 28th. So a lot of different things are happening, and The ride-out opinion is one of two until I filed my lawsuit, and I could be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure we have about three active federal cases going on relating to ballot selfie. There's ride-out v. Gardner, which I'll return to. There's the ACLU of Indiana versus the Indiana Secretary of State, which that's a proceeding into summary judgment. That also achieved at the district court level a preliminary injunction against a ballot selfie prohibition in October of last year. And then our case is just starting, and we're hoping to proceed to preliminary injunction pretty soon. It's important to note that both Rideout, the New Hampshire law, and the Indiana law that were at issue were very specific laws passed to target ballot selfies. For a long time, there's a lot of laws on the books that have traditionally related to exposing one's ballot within a polling place. And as I'll discuss, when it comes to the Michigan case, the Secretary of State has taken the position that that extends to prohibiting anyone from taking a picture even of their own ballot and posting it. But in Rideout v. Gardner, the law was challenged because it was passed in 2014. And it said it had been the law had been specifically amended to say that the prohibition shall include taking a digital image or photograph of his or her marked ballot and distributing or sharing the image via social media or by any other means. So we had a specific law targeting it, and the facts of this case, of course, are pretty interesting. Three different people, three different plaintiffs at least, one of them actually a legislator in New Hampshire, and one of them, perhaps most colorfully, took a picture of his ballot having written in the name of his recently deceased pet and saying that all the Republicans were such terrible candidates that he went ahead and wrote in Akira. Upon being informed that they were actually being investigated by the Attorney General in New Hampshire, they brought this lawsuit and proceeded through district court with a very good ruling on that end, and then proceeded up to the First Circuit. Notably, oral argument, though this case goes back about 2 years and the opinion from the district court is about a year old, between oral argument in the middle of September and this opinion being released by the First Circuit, this was particularly expeditious. I certainly give the First Circuit a lot of credit for coming to terms so quickly. The case is builds on some recent First Amendment precedents. A lot of people really emphasized the district court's opinion because it built upon Reed versus Town of Gilbert and determined that this was a content-based restriction on speech. We've had teleforms in the past. I certainly recommend listening to them on the implications of Reed v. Town of Gilbert, which is, I thought, just a very good affirmance of what content-based means. But is still actually having a lot of making a lot of waves as to how far that really goes, and by distinguishing between a marked ballot at the district court level, they said that the judge said that distinguishing between a marked ballot and an unmarked ballot, well, you have to look at the content of the speech, so we have a content-based restriction. The First Circuit Court of Appeals, however, decided not to address that and said that even under intermediate scrutiny, that this fails. Now, this is really important because a year before the Reed decision, before we had the game changer, so-called, on content-based analysis, there was a case called McCullen versus Coakley, which was a case regarding 35-foot buffer zones around abortion clinics in Massachusetts. This was another case of a new law but building on a lot of different precedents relating to restrictions around abortion places. The court nevertheless decided even under intermediate scrutiny, even though it was not a content-based restriction, even under intermediate scrutiny that this law fails. And there's some excellent discussion for a long time. I've certainly seen this in the campaign finance arena, where intermediate scrutiny is often treated just about as lackadaisically as rational basis. But to look at McCullen v. Coakley, we see that even if a law is not content-based, intermediate scrutiny requires not the tailoring to look not toward least restrictive means, which we see in the strict scrutiny context, that the government must find the least restrictive means possible to narrowly tailor the law to address a compelling governmental interest, but in even reasonably tailoring something to address an important governmental interest under intermediate scrutiny, you must nevertheless look toward less restrictive means or less intrusive means by which to address that governmental interest. So particularly here in Rideout, the opinion really goes through and says, well, okay, you have issues of the compelling issues that interest here are perhaps harassment within polling places or distraction within polling places, but that doesn't really come into play, you know, because people are just within the voting booth snapping a quick photo and then posting it online. It's quite possible one of the reasons, and I've looked at this in the Michigan case that I'm bringing, I think the reason people are so-called getting away with this is because no one notices they're doing it, quite simply. This is not really an act that's particularly occurring in occurring very loudly. But more importantly, though, we can't sit here and look at the vote-buying things that were going on. This is the reason we have a secret ballot, the so-called Australian ballot, because that's where it originated, the idea of the secret ballot. You can't look at all the problems that were going on in the 1800s with vote buying and the like and just say, well, we're always going to have these problems, so therefore we shall forever have a compelling or important governmental interest, and we can ban photography, ban an entire platform of communication that I should add as well outside the polling place, social media. If you take a picture and post it online, the odds of that being seen actually within the polling place, unless you have somebody there with you who's looking at their phone and happens to be on your social media account at the very time, are pretty low. So interestingly, this is both the Rideout opinion now at the First Circuit as well as the Indiana District Court's opinion in ACLU, Indiana Secretary of State, are both really concise about this, both saying, well, under the McCullen precedent, you can't just say an interest, and again, this is at least saving intermediate scrutiny to a certain extent from falling into the rational basis hole. You have to actually prove up that there's some kind of issue that you're actually addressing, and then you have to show us that there are less restrictive means by which you can go. If the plaintiff shows us there's less restrictive means by which you can do that, you're going to be accountable to that. So, you know, before I close my opening remarks, I really want to reemphasize the exciting aspect, I think, of ballot selfies. That it's so fascinating that we look, and there's many issues involving polling places, you know, integrity of the vote, making sure that voters are not intimidated or even, you know, those are very important issues. But this is an exciting new thing going on, and I think people are very, whatever your thoughts are on the selfie generation, whatever your thoughts are about millennials, and being a millennial, I can certainly speak to them myself. This is something that we speak all often about, turning out the youth vote and wanting people, young people, to start getting engaged more early. And then to threaten them in the case of with misdemeanors or with even forfeiting their vote for engaging in something that is not an act of vote buying, but is probably 999,000 times out of a million a chance to express unequivocally who they voted for, to celebrate the fact that they voted. This is core political speech. Take all of the different precedents, Buckley versus Valeo and other political speech cases, that this is the core of the First Amendment. This is core free speech. This is why we passed the First Amendment, so that people could criticize those in power or support those in power and to speak freely about politics. And the secrecy of the ballot should be I would argue a one-way street. I think the state, of course, is obligated to keep people's votes secret, but that voter, the voter yourself, your own ballot, I don't think secrecy should extend to that point. So I do want to close with that I think that however silly people may find selfies in general, however silly people might even find ballot selfies, this is a fundamental reason why we have a First Amendment. I don't think this is a particularly difficult area, and I'm frankly taken aback and surprised at the how certain authorities have dug in. Having said that, along with these court cases that are going along, it is exciting to see state by state so many legislatures and other authorities weighing in and saying, no, this is not something that we are going to prohibit any longer. So with that, I'd be welcome questions.
Okay, very good, Steve. We will move ahead with questions. I will now open the floor for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompting, which indicates that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then pound. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then pound on your telephone keypad. Before we get to the first question, I just want to make an announcement that our next scheduled Teleform conference call will be tomorrow, Friday, October 7th at 1 p.m. We will host a Courthouse Steps Teleform about yesterday's Supreme Court oral arguments in the Solomon case. That case is from the Ninth Circuit and grapples with the issue of what constitutes a personal benefit for establishing insider trading. For that discussion, we will have with us Todd Braunstein, who is the global head of legal investigations for Willis, Towers, and Watson. Okay, looks like we do have a question ready, and we'll go to it now.
Hi, this is Will Trackman at Littler Mendelson in Denver. I had a concern about the level of scrutiny that courts should be applying here. I am a little bit concerned that the state interest is expiring. Obviously, there was a state interest in the 19th century in prohibiting sharing of voted ballots. And it sounds like courts are arbitrarily deciding that that interest has expired. What guidelines should courts apply in determining the expiration date on an interest that was compelling at one time and may no longer be? And I find it interesting that a lot of courts are saying, well, vote buying isn't a concern anymore. The state hasn't shown that vote buying happens frequently, when of course they couldn't because they've had these laws in place. So I'm hard pressed to think of a good standard that courts should be applying on the scrutiny aspect.
Well, my two comments on that are that, first, it's interesting the under-inclusive nature of a lot of these states, and I'm not speaking for all states, but in the lawsuit that I have going in Michigan right now, which is Crookston v. Johnson, which people can follow at our website, pillaroflaw.org, the aspect of that Michigan prohibits the publication of photographs, at least under their interpretation, of ballots, marked ballots, from that are actually filled out within the polling place. That can't be posted on social media, but has no restrictions whatsoever on someone photographing or displaying, I should add, in any way, their absentee ballot before submitting that. Kind of speaks to this under-inclusive nature that how can this law be really saying it's tailored to address an interest when if allegedly vote buying is so sensitive that it's being implicated by this? How can you have such a disparity in the prohibitions? I think the second point that I would mention is that this is so overt, particularly the idea of ballot selfies that are actually published. Now, I understand photography, someone could take a picture of their ballot and not post it on social media, but just have it and then thereby perhaps facilitate that transaction. But when someone is going out of their way to broadcast to the world on a social media platform that what they're doing, that in and of itself certainly is not a problem. And I should add that as far as investigations go, what you have done, that when you put something out there on social media, it's certainly not a confidential kind of communication. And I think if there's seriously, I would imagine any law enforcement agency even would look at that and say, well, that alone doesn't really give us anything to work with. But the fact is, if the ballot selfie, if the posting of a ballot selfie really is so dangerous and so implicates that would allow police agencies to maybe do some real police work and go and investigate further, perhaps. So far, I can say that the response we received to preliminary injunction in our Crookston case in Michigan is sparse. The idea that they can bring up allegations of vote buying. There's one case they referenced from 2010 that is basically an allegation that never went anywhere. And then there is a case that involving absentee ballots that was prosecuted, and I should add prosecuted successfully and upheld on appeal. So as far as, again, when you're bringing that sparse of a record, and I think New Hampshire, the First Circuit, was also very taken aback by this, is now am I concerned that we have, you know, I've long on the policy side advocated for just about sunset provisions in just about everything that's not malum in se criminal law, but I do think there certainly comes a point if that, and as many as there are concerns, you know, we could certainly parallel it to the NFIB versus Sebelius case. We have no idea where that gun to the head idea came from, where we forced states to have Medicaid expansion. But I think we're all pretty happy that the court drew a line somewhere. And I think that this is certainly not that danger. But if that danger does arise, it's not to say that the courts can't readdress that.
Okay, I think we will go to our next caller. Just a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter star, then pound on your telephone keypad.
David Emerson with the Berkeley Federalist Chapter. Apart from the vote-buying concern, I mean, I'd like to get the speaker's reaction to other similar, but not necessarily as serious, but still very significant concerns having to do with just the value of anonymity or being able to claim anonymity in casting a ballot versus the social pressure or social intimidation factor of not posting a ballot if it becomes a widespread practice, or the expectation that one would post one's ballot. And not only just not so much as in a general election, but in particular in, for example, an election involving certification of a union at a workplace, which just might involve a few dozen workers, where there might be an extreme amount of pressure asserted and an expectation that if you don't post your ballot self, then the presumption will be against you and you may be the victim of union thuggery. I'd like to get your sense of those cases as well, the social intimidation case and the union certification case.
And forgive my answer, but I'm going to go. I'm going to jump up here to 10,000 feet and reference a little bit more of some of the First Amendment work that I'm engaged in. And this is interesting because the same technological advancements that we're talking about here for the ballot selfie. Your own phone that you have on you at any time, you can snap a picture at any time. I should also add that it's interesting the amount of citizen investigations that these kind of technology has allowed. The vast majority of states, for example, allow for individuals to secretly record their very own conversations, and that can often be used as evidence in court, et cetera. I happen to be involved in a lawsuit in Massachusetts, one of the few states with draconian recording provisions that don't allow you to record under any circumstances unless you have everybody's consent in the conversation. So the interesting thing is, along with this new form of expression, a lot of the accountability that people are concerned with, this technology is allowing for it. And that's another thing to be very excited about, that citizen investigators, that even, you know, guerrilla journalism, we see the photographing police issues that are coming up, the videotaping police. There is a point where even that anonymity factor can be, you might not even, when you're being intimidated, you might not necessarily have to even reveal yourself to have the person who's intimidating you be busted. You might just have to be pretty creative about it. From the other aspect, there's a point, and I don't mean to be too cheeky about this, but in the campaign finance context, we've watched the concerns with intimidation and pressure be completely dismissed by the so-called reform community. And that's when government is supporting campaign finance disclosure that is so minute that it allows for the disclosure and posting on the internet of names of people who donated, you know, $50 to a ballot initiative that is of a perhaps controversial nature, and then finding themselves subject to all sorts of everything from minor harassment to death threats. And that's something we're supposed to just chill out about. But then, conversely, some of these same reform-oriented types are flipping out about a person exposing their own ballot, their own vote. So I don't have too much sympathy on that side, though I certainly have written in favor of anonymity. I think there's a vast difference and a very important distinction between the government, as I said earlier, exposing your vote or exposing your political beliefs, and a citizen deciding to do it on his or her own. But ultimately, I really think that we're losing. We too often focus here on this specific act and not realizing a lot of this fallout. The same technology that is, I believe, serves as the reason to assuage a lot of these old governmental concerns is also going to be a solution to those exact same concerns.
Okay. The lines are wide open. If you'd like to ask a call of Steve Klein, or I'm sorry, ask a question of Steve Klein at this time, please press star and then pound on your telephone keypad. While the lines are open, I just want to remind everyone to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls. You can also consult our full schedule of upcoming teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. We also have podcasts of previously recorded teleforum calls that you may have missed there. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter star and then pound on your keypad. Steve, it looks like we've answered all the questions we have for now. Is there any concluding remarks or additional remarks you'd like to make at this time?
Well, I'd like to thank everybody. First of all, thanks, Nate, and the Federalist Society for having me. I want to thank everybody for calling in. This issue, as I said, it's very hot right now. I don't think it's going to go away between now and Election Day, certainly. I think given the controversies surrounding the elections, I hope to see a lot of ballot selfies posted. Some of them I certainly hope are going to be in line with certainly protest voting, but we'll see. We'll see where that goes. And I think in the coming years, given the opposition we saw in the New Hampshire case from the state, given the opposition we're taking on right now in Michigan, I do think this is going to remain a very hot issue. And I certainly hope people with any interest in a First Amendment, particularly I know this teleforum, we're going out nationwide. You might take a look at state laws and certainly pillarofLaw.org, and you can certainly reach out to us. We're pretty well versed in First Amendment law, and political engagement by citizens is our mission. And I think this is, again, whatever you might think about money in politics or any of those more deep First Amendment issues, this is about as basic as it gets. And I certainly hope that we can vindicate the rights of our client and Michigan voters. And that's probably too long of a closing. But again, thank you so much, and thanks again, Nate.
Not at all. Very good. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Steve Klein for joining us today. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next teleforum tomorrow at 1 p.m. Thank you for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.